Possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. All I need is a good night's sleep. Who hasn't uttered those words? But getting a good night's sleep is not a sure bet for many of us. An estimated 47 million Americans suffer sleep problems. Today we'll talk about what's keeping us up with Dr. Meir Krieger. Dr. Krieger is an MD who has been diagnosing and treating people with sleep disorders for more than 25 years. He's the chief editor of a widely used medical textbook on sleep disorders, Principles and Practice of Sleep Medicine. He's also the author of a new book for lay readers about women and sleep disorders, A Woman's Guide to Sleep Disorders. The book is published in the U.S. by McGraw-Hill. Listeners, I invite your questions about sleep and sleep disorders for Dr. Krieger. I look forward to your telephone calls. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free line, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. Dr. Meir Krieger is a past president of both the American Sleep Association and the Canadian Sleep Society. He is currently vice president of the National Sleep Foundation. He is also currently the director of the St. Boniface Sleep Lab in Winnipeg, Canada. Again, the phone number is 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Dr. Krieger, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Celeste.
I know now that women sleep differently than men. What are the differences?
Well, the differences are related to biology. Women have very different hormonal function, as every woman knows, and women's sleep is interrupted by their periods, by pregnancy, and by menopause. And very often, women are much more likely to develop disorders such as, for example, depression, and depression is known to worsen sleep as well. So sleep affects women very, very differently than it does men.
Yeah. Other than insomnia, you know, before I had spent some time with this book, A Woman's Guide to Sleep Disorders, I had thought of sleep disorders like apnea, narcolepsy, and restless leg syndrome as disorders more prevalent in men.
Mm-hmm. That is actually a common myth or a common misconception. Most people believe that sleep apnea is a disease of men who are in their late 40s, who are overweight, who snore and stop breathing. And interestingly, until about 1993, most doctors didn't believe that sleep apnea occurred in women at all. And we now know that sleep apnea is extremely common in women, particularly postmenopausal women, and they may present a little bit differently than men do. So there has been, in the last 15 or 20 years, basically a bias against the diagnosis of sleep apnea in women, but we now know that it's actually quite common in women.
Yeah, and also restless leg syndrome common in women.
Yeah, restless leg syndrome is extremely common in women, and very often it begins during pregnancy. And one of the reasons that why it's so much more common in women than it is in men has to do with iron. We now know that iron plays an important role in people not having restless legs, and if iron levels are very low, that's one of the risk factors to develop restless leg syndrome. And basically, women are much more likely to become iron deficient precisely because they have menstrual cycles and they lose blood every month. So women are much more prone to develop restless leg syndrome.
Yeah. There's also a very interesting case in the book of a man who went to his doctor, was very tired, wasn't sleeping well. It turned out his iron levels were low. He had cancer.
Yeah. Yeah. The what was very often people don't make connections, and everybody assumes that if someone has cancer and is very, very tired and very, very, very sleepy, that the cause of the problem is simply their cancer. And what was interesting about this particular gentleman is that his he actually had restless leg syndrome, and the restless leg syndrome was actually present before the cancer was diagnosed. And in his case, it had been caused by a slow loss of iron from the body, because he had cancer in his intestines, was losing a small amount of blood, and that's what actually led to his restless leg syndrome. So in him, that was actually the first symptom of his cancer.
Yeah. Also, this anecdote, this story, points out the importance of communicating with the family doctor about what's going on.
Yeah. Whenever I see a patient and they use certain words, very often the words are vague, and very often, this is all people, it's not just women. All people need to learn to communicate to their doctors so that they explain to them not what their interpretation of the symptom is, but they should describe the circumstance. And I can't tell you how often people tell me they're tired, they tell me they're fatigued, and that is actually a very, very vague term. It doesn't really help the doctor a whole lot. For example, if someone tells me they fall asleep at movies, they fall asleep during a meeting, or they fall asleep at work, that tells me something very, very specific. And so when people go to their doctor, they shouldn't try to diagnose themselves. What they should try to do is to describe the circumstances of their symptoms so that the doctor can actually get onto the right track in terms of making a diagnosis.
Yeah. And also bring to the doctor's attention something like if the spouse is saying, mm-hmm. honey, you know, you're snoring, or you're scaring me to death because you're stopping, you're not breathing.
Mm-hmm.
So those kinds of things also would be important to talk about with your doctor. Although these kinds of things are things we hardly ever think about talking with the doctor.
Well, interestingly enough, not only is it important that a spouse bring to the attention of their bed partner that there's a problem, but I try to encourage patients to bring their bed partner with them when they come to the interview.
Oh.
And the reason is, very often people, especially men, do not believe that they snore or how much they snore. And when the bed partner is there and actually describes what is going on, very often for the first time does the patient realize how distressing what they do is to the other person. And this is something that is very, very important. When the bed partner says, you know, you stop breathing and it frightens me, and I'm waiting for you to start breathing again, that has a very, very powerful impact on the patient and makes them realize, you know, maybe I do have a big problem.
Yeah. Also, what was good to realize is that these problems can often be solved quite simply.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. One of the very gratifying things about sleep disorders medicine is that most of the conditions that we see can actually be diagnosed and they can actually be treated. So in some ways, it's very gratifying. Patients with sleep apnea, for example, can go from being unable to stay awake and being pathologically sleepy, unable to function, to being virtually normal within a matter of days of starting treatment. And that's something that we don't see very often in medicine. So most of the conditions that we see can be diagnosed and they can be treated, but they need to be suspected. Most doctors, and there have been some surveys that have looked at this, never ever ask their patients anything about sleep ever in any visit. So it's something that we need to teach doctors. We need to teach doctors to ask their patients about their sleep.
Yeah. You know, I don't think that's anything a doctor has ever asked me.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's so critical.
Yeah.
And here's a really basic question. How important is sleep to our health and well-being?
Well, it's critically important. You know, in one extreme, for example, it is known from animal research that if you don't allow an animal to sleep, it'll eventually die. And so we know that there's something that happens during sleep that is absolutely critical to us staying alive. There are so many things that happen during sleep in terms of repair of tissues, hormones being secreted, breathing needs to be maintained. The body does not really go to sleep. It goes into a different kind of state, and it does a whole bunch of very important things, and it's only really been in the last 15 or 20 years that we're beginning to understand all these important processes that are occurring during sleep.
Yeah. How do you describe a good night's sleep?
Well, the best way to describe a good night's sleep is how you feel in the morning. And if you feel wide awake, optimistic, bright-eyed, and bushy-tailed, and all of us have had that sensation, we know that we have had a good night's sleep. And most people who don't have a good night's sleep, what they tell you is, I wake up and I feel unrefreshed. I'm not ready to go. I feel like I need to go back to sleep. And that's the main variable that people will understand is how they feel during the daytime. For example, if you go to work and you need to have a cup of coffee in order to function, mm-hmm. you're probably sleep-deprived or you haven't had normal sleep. In other words, it's the daytime function and how you feel during the daytime which is going to tell you how good your sleep was at night.
Hmm. And if you don't wake up bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, and this happens over and over and over again, mm-hmm. how do you tease out what's going on? Why don't I get a good night's sleep? How do you begin to investigate that?
Well, you need to investigate it first by trying to get a sense of the person's lifestyle, what their life is like. Generally, a person is sleepy for one of two reasons. They either haven't slept enough or they have a disorder that is making it difficult for them to get the right amount and the right quality of sleep. Now, nowadays, the average person sleeps about an hour less than they did about 100 years ago. So many people are actually sleep-deprived simply because of lifestyle. Now, in women, women, as most of your listeners will attest, are often the last person to go to bed at night. They're often the first person to get up first thing in the morning. They are often also the caregiver if there's somebody in the house who's sick, whether it's an elderly parent or whether it's a child or sometimes even a pet. And so women tend to be sleep-deprived in modern society simply because of lifestyle. And so when a person comes to me and complains of being sleepy, the first thing I look at is the quality of their life. Are they shift workers? Are they losing a lot of sleep because of all these other activities? And then if none of those is a factor, we then start to look at possible medical conditions. And then we look at things like medications. There are many people who are taking medications that make them sleepy. If someone, for example, has insomnia, we need to make sure that the insomnia is not being caused by excessive caffeine intake, for example. I had a patient that I saw about a week ago, a gentleman who had terrible insomnia, and he basically said, I only sleep about 3 or 4 hours a night. And it turns out that this guy was drinking 16 cups of coffee a day. And I said to him, you know, that's an awful lot of coffee. And he said to me, the coffee does not affect me. And I kind of shook my head, because there's a great deal of research that shows that caffeine can interfere with your sleep, but some people do not make the connection of I'm drinking 15 cups of coffee a day, and therefore I'm not sleeping, and maybe what I need to do is to cut back on the caffeine. So there are things that we do during the daytime that will cause us to have very bad sleep at night.
Yeah, and there's a case of a woman in the book who was a truck driver, mm-hmm. and she was drinking liters of soda pop a day.
And the funny thing about this person was she was working for a company that actually bottled the soda pop. and she got it for free, and she figured, well, you know, I'm going to drink this stuff because I like it and I'm not paying for it, and that was her problem. That was the sole reason for her having insomnia.
Yeah, and she thought it was she wasn't getting good sleep at night, but she was really tired during the day and drowsy behind the wheel, and she thought drinking that pop would help keep her going.
And it did. You know, it did keep her going, but she was stuck in a vicious circle. And that's something that often happens in people who are basically drinking too much coffee or addicted to the coffee, is that to the caffeine, is that their sleep is poor, they're tired during the daytime, they have a lot of caffeine in order to stay alert, and they're stuck in this, and they need to get out of it, and the first thing they need to do is to dramatically reduce caffeine intake. Drinking more than about 2 or 3 cups a day, especially in the afternoon, is likely to lead to problems with sleep.
Yeah. If we're having a problem sleeping, is it a good idea to kind of take a look at how your day unfolds? I get up at this time, I have this, I have this to eat and drink, then I do this, and then I do that, and dinner time is at such and such a time, and, you know, what your daily routine is.
Yeah, I think what you're describing is keeping a kind of a diary, and we actually recommend this for a lot of people who are having a severe sleep problem, is to try to keep track of what they're doing during the daytime. And you'd be amazed how often the problem is that someone has, for example, gotten into the habit of taking very, very long naps during the daytime. I saw a patient earlier this week, a woman, who was basically complaining to me that she only slept 2-3 hours a night, and she was very distressed by this. And it turned out that she took about 5 hours worth of naps during the daytime. And so basically what had happened with her was she kind of got her days and her nights mixed up. But if you added up the total amount of time that she slept over 24 hours, it actually wasn't bad, but it was distributed wrong. So if someone, for example, is having trouble sleeping at night, they need to pay attention to, am I napping, and how long are my naps, and if my naps are very long, how do I feel after them, and should I actually be doing that? In general, what we recommend for someone who has insomnia, that if they nap, that the naps should be kept short, 15 to 30 minutes. Longer naps will interfere with the ability to fall asleep that night and can also lead to an interesting phenomenon, which has the scientific name of sleep inertia. What your listeners will realize is that if they have a very, very long nap, they sometimes feel very, very groggy for either a short time or a long time after the nap, and they're actually not very functional.
Yeah.
So, and that only happens really with very long naps, so people should avoid taking very long naps.
This is the Afternoon Magazine, and today we're talking about sleep and sleep problems with Dr. Meir Krieger. He's an MD who's been diagnosing and treating people with sleep disorders for more than 25 years now. He's chief editor of a widely used medical textbook on sleep disorders, Principles and Practice of Sleep Medicine. He's also now the author of a new book for lay readers about women and sleep disorders, A Woman's Guide to Sleep Disorders. The book is published in the U.S. by McGraw-Hill. And also, this book, I think, is good even if you're not a woman. I think there's a lot of good information in here about sleep and sleep disorders, whether you're a man or a woman. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, phone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. WILL. We have a couple of listeners waiting to talk with us. First, we go to Aurora, line 4. Good afternoon.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
Great programming. About 3 weeks ago, I slept all night, and I'm trying desperately to think of what I did during the day that gave me that restful night's sleep. I have given up coffee about a good month ago. I've tried a lot of things. What you didn't mention, and I listened very, very carefully to everything you've been saying, My daughter gave me a nightgown about a year ago, and when I sleep in that nightgown, it's a knitted nightgown. It is so cozy, and I just relax. It doesn't make me sleep, but it makes me so much more comfortable. I think sleepwear helps.
Sleepwear is actually very important, and it's very important in some menopausal women, perimenopausal women. During the perimenopause and in the early menopausal years, many women feel hot during the night. They have night sweats, and some of them will actually wake up and be soaked. So having the right kind of bedclothes is actually very important. And there are some bedclothes now that are made with materials that actually allow the perspiration to actually go right through them. And you can actually buy some of these products via the internet. And for some women, they sleep way better when they have these products because they no longer wake up very, very warm. Now, the other thing to remember is that anything which makes you more relaxed is something that will help your sleep. And knowing that you're sleeping in something that was given to you and knitted by a close, important relative is probably something that we can't measure, but it's probably very important.
So what are you saying we could do? You haven't given a list yet of things to do to help you?
Okay. The most important thing to do is not to worry if you're having a problem every now and again. What very often happens is that someone has a real bad night, and then they become obsessed and they start to focus on their very poor sleep for that one night. And when you're in bed and you're trying very, very hard to fall asleep and you become angry and frustrated, you're simply not going to fall asleep. So one of the things that I try to encourage people is don't think about your sleep that much. If you're feeling very, very good during the daytime and you're wide awake and alert and you have a bad night every now and again because of stress, something that you've watched on television has upset you, don't worry too much about that. Now, there are some things that people can do that can help a lot. I advise people to basically never get into any detailed discussion about money. No arguments at bedtime. Get rid of the television. You don't need it. There are some people, for example, who have a computer in their bedroom. Their email system is always on. They don't sleep deeply because they're thinking about, my God, I'm going to be getting an email at 3 o'clock in the morning and so forth. I tell people to get rid of their alarm clocks. And why get rid of their alarm clocks? Very often, if someone is having trouble sleeping, they look at their alarm clock and they're thinking, my God, it's now 2 o'clock in the morning and I haven't slept. And so something like an alarm clock can actually make you feel more anxious about not sleeping than if it really weren't there. So these are some of the, and there are many things that people can do to improve their sleep, and these are simply some of them. But if you have a bad night every now and again, it's really not something to be too concerned about.
I have a good night every once in a while, as opposed to what you just said. Could it be an inherited factor?
Absolutely. It can be inherited. Somewhere between 5 and 10% of people who have insomnia have what we call primary insomnia, and it's something that they're born with. And usually, even when they were very, very young, their parents told them, you know, you always had trouble sleeping. You were a wriggly kid. You were so much different from your brothers and sisters. And people with primary insomnia, they're born with, if you will, slightly different connections in their brain system that makes you fall asleep. And they will often have this problem their entire life. And they don't have a psychiatric condition. They don't have any other condition. It's just that the wiring in their brain is a little bit different. And people like that usually will end up needing some sort of help in order to actually fall asleep. And so it is inherited. Now, the other thing that is inherited, by the way, is restless leg syndrome.
Well, I don't have that, thank God.
Yeah. And now, sometimes with restless leg syndrome, people don't have the symptoms lying in bed, but they have a variant that's called periodic limb movements in sleep. They fall asleep, but the entire night they twitch, and they twitch about every 15 to 30 seconds, and it's the twitching during sleep that actually wakes them up and gives them this non-refreshing sleep. So we're still learning a great deal about sleep, and we don't have all of the answers for everybody, but I'm telling you, we know dramatically more than we knew 5 years ago, and even more than 15 or 20 years ago. The whole field is only about 20 years old.
Yeah. I want to thank the listener for her call and wish her a good night's sleep. And
yep.
We've got a couple of other people waiting to talk with us. Next, we're going to go to a listener in Champaign, line one. Hi.
Yes, hello. I'm calling. Have you all talked about sleep apnea at this point?
A little bit.
Well, anyway, I'm calling to try to personalize it somewhat. I read an article about Reggie White, mm-hmm. the great NFL defensive lineman who died recently. One of the contributing causes was, I believe, his sleep apnea. And I also have a person who comes from my hometown in Arkansas who weighs about 350 pounds and is a rookie offensive lineman in the NFL. And he suffers from sleep apnea and indicated in an article in USA Today that he was getting his tonsils removed to alleviate somewhat the problem. The NFL, I understand, is looking at a possibility of a causal relationship between the huge sizes of its offensive and defensive linemen and their increased risk with suffering from sleep apnea. Is that a reason for concern in the NFL and any other place where in our country obesity is a major problem?
Well, when you look at very obese people, about half of them are going to have sleep apnea. In other words, once people weigh more than 300 pounds, a very large number are going to have sleep apnea. Now, there's actually some published medical literature looking at the issue of sleep apnea in NFL players. And this was published about 2 years ago, actually almost exactly 2 years ago, because it was published during the week of Super Bowl. And it turned out that about 30% of NFL linemen, people actually playing football, these are not retirees, 30% of them had sleep apnea, and it's a very common problem in people that are that heavy. And one of the things that this study highlighted was you could be a really healthy-appearing person. I mean, who's healthier than somebody playing for the NFL, but you can have a terrible problem such as sleep apnea. Now, what Reggie died from, we really don't know, because he had a couple of other medical problems.
Right.
And I don't know how well documented the sleep apnea was in him. That's something that I didn't come across in any of the media. It was something that was just mentioned. But we do know for sure that football players who are linemen, who are very heavy, who have 19 to 21, 22-inch necks, they are at risk of developing and having sleep apnea.
And with that transfer generally to a society where two-thirds, I just read a statistic that two-thirds of Americans are either overweight or obese,
yep.
that
yep.
would be a risk, increased risk, at least for those who are in the morbid obese category.
Well, not just for the morbid obese. It's actually a problem for anybody who is overweight. We start to see sleep apnea in men. We generally measure what's called the body mass index, and there are many places on the web where you can have that measured. You put in your height, you put in your weight, and it calculates something called body mass index. Our average patient has a body mass index of about 33, and that isn't morbidly obese. When we're talking about morbidly obese, the number is 40 and above. And when we're looking at 40 and above, and this is very often people, depending on their height, weighing more than 250 or 300 pounds, about a third to half of them have sleep apnea. And you're absolutely right when you say that about two-thirds of the American population is now overweight. This has been a very distressing trend. A couple of years ago, the Surgeon General of the United States actually brought that to everybody's attention. People were sort of very familiar with that. And just yesterday, the Health and Human Services issued new dietary guidelines for Americans. And if you go to the hhs.gov website, you can download them. And the main focus of these new guidelines is to lose weight, because the average American is now overweight. In contrast, in the mid-60s, only about 25% of Americans were overweight. So the number of overweight people has almost tripled.
Well, thank you, sir.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Dr. Krieger, remember here, given that we've been talking now a little bit about sleep apnea, would you talk with us about continuous positive airway pressure treatment?
Yeah. The continuous positive airway pressure was actually introduced in the mid-1980s, and it's an interesting treatment. The problem with sleep apnea is the breathing passage collapses as the person is struggling to breathe. And what this treatment does is it supplies a little bit of positive pressure and via a mask that fits over the nose. And the way you can imagine it working is if you take a balloon and you put in a little bit of pressure, you fill it up a little bit, the walls separate. And that's exactly how CPAP works. And people who use CPAP, their obstructive sleep apnea goes away, or it's improved dramatically, and they're now able to sleep without having all these events of stopping breathing.
Yeah. Is it comfortable?
Is it comfortable? The answer is no. And about one-fifth of patients have trouble with it. But even though it's uncomfortable, there are a lot of people who love it, because if they don't use it, they feel absolutely rotten the next day.
Yeah.
And so right now it's the best treatment that we have, and it's not great treatment in the sense that it's a little bit uncomfortable, for some people very uncomfortable, but when it works really well. The other treatment that we will often use, Celeste, is that if someone isn't very overweight or their apnea is not too severe, we will sometimes recommend a dental appliance that they wear only at night that brings their lower jaw upwards and forwards. And in many people, this actually solves their apnea problem.
Hmm.
And that's something that you can discuss with your doctor and or your dentist.
Okay, very good. Let's go on and talk with some other listeners. Next, we go to McLean County. Line 2, hi.
Hello. I want to tell you, I cannot believe how excited I am that yeah, Dr. Krieger is on the airway, because I have been actually considering calling you guys and asking you to have someone about sleep problems. I used to be one of those persons who I could lay down and within 5 minutes I'd be gone, you know, out.
Mm-hmm.
And for about 2 years, I go to bed and I lay there and I lay there, and yes, I do watch the alarm clock, or I'll start thinking about stuff, and I can't stop thinking. I used to be able to, where I'll do a meditation, I'd fall asleep, or do something and fall asleep. And now it's gotten to where 8 o'clock p.m., I am bum tired, and by the time I get ready and go to bed, and I am the last person going to bed, taking care of the dogs and everything, get to bed by 10 o'clock, and I'm absolutely wide awake. It's not that I'm just getting a second wind. And I'm having hot flashes and all those good things, and
yeah.
I don't know what to do, and I don't know where to go next. So,
What you're describing is actually, and I don't want to diagnose you over the telephone, so
that's fine,
because I haven't seen you ever. But one of the things I want to point out is that if someone gets into bed and they're dead tired until they get into bed, and all of a sudden they're wired. And they're wide awake, they're alert, they can't fall asleep, and their mind is racing, and they can't turn it off, is that what a person like that has is something that we call psychophysiologic insomnia. And what it is that the bed has now become, if you will, a stimulus to wake you up, and your mind is racing, and you can't turn your mind off. And one of the big breakthroughs in the treatment of that in the last little while has been something called cognitive behavioral therapy. And many people need to learn again how to shut off their minds when they go to sleep. Some people, their minds race, they just can't turn it off. And this is something that you never even used to think about. It was automatic. Mm-hmm. And psychologists who utilize or who use cognitive behavioral therapy, they have extremely good results. Usually about 70 to 80% of their patients will improve without using medications. So it's quite possible that you have something like that. I would discuss that issue with your doctor to make sure that you don't have restless leg syndrome, that this isn't simply because of hot flashes that you're having trouble. Some women who are having hot flashes, many women have stopped taking hormones because of all the bad press related to the Women's Health Initiative study. And there are some women whose sleep is so terrible without hormones that they should really consider they should really rethink it. And maybe they do need hormones for a couple of years if they're having terrible sleep problems. So for a postmenopausal woman, this is actually a very difficult time because we don't really know what to advise every woman who's having these kind of symptoms.
Mm-hmm. The question, and if you don't mind, is like around 8 o'clock. I am like I could fall asleep just if mm-hmm. I could lay down.
Yeah.
But then you know it's like some of those things where I'm not used to going to bed at 8 because I don't want to be getting up at 3 in the morning. And then I have to take care of the dogs and whatever, and I get to bed, and I'm wide awake. My mind may or may not be racing at the time, but it's just like it's all of a sudden like someone turned the bright lights on.
Yeah, and that's a textbook description of psychophysiologic insomnia. In other words, the reason for the term, you might not be familiar with the concept of a conditioned reflex. But if you took psychology as an undergraduate college student, one of the things that you learned about was Pavlov's dogs,
yes,
when the dogs hear a bell, eventually they start to salivate because the bell was associated with food. What happens to a lot of people is they become conditioned to the bed being a place where they don't fall asleep. So even though they are really tired, they get into their bed. And all of a sudden, it's like exactly what you described. Somebody turned on the light and woke them up. Now, interestingly, very often, when we study someone like that in our sleep laboratory, they have no trouble falling asleep in our beds in the hospital here. Mm-hmm. And what it is that the problem that they have is often in their own bed, in their own environment, and they need to basically deal with that issue. And again, there's treatment for cognitive behavioral therapy, and not usually with medications.
Okay, because I tried Ambien and it was a disaster.
Yeah,
I was feeling like 10 times worse when I woke up in the morning.
Yeah,
and I tried to take 2 doses.
Yeah,
that was it.
Yeah, you bring up an important point. Is that sleeping pills? If someone has a specific one of the things I always try to emphasize is that very often insomnia is a symptom of something, and that something needs to be diagnosed. We need to figure out what the problem really is. Is it psychophysiologic insomnia? Is it restless leg syndrome? Is it caffeine? Or is it anxiety? Is it depression? And we have to make sure that the underlying cause is being treated. And in a situation where the underlying cause is a conditioned one, a psychophysiologic one, that's what needs to be treated. And a medication in that kind of situation, as you describe, may actually make it worse. And you may feel very, very groggy the next day.
I want to thank the listener for her call this afternoon. And we're going to take another call. Listener in Champaign, line 3. Hello.
Hello. I have 2 quick questions. The first is, do you have any advice about what to do if you've been referred to a sleep laboratory for study and this is not covered by your health insurance?
Boy, that's a tough one. It all depends on what symptoms you have and what they're thinking about and whether or not the test is actually going to help in making a decision about your treatment. For example, most of the time, if someone has insomnia, they don't necessarily need a sleep test in order to be treated because the cause can often be found. However, if one suspects sleep apnea and the person is very, very sleepy and snores and has been observed to stop breathing, then they will usually need a sleep test in order to figure out, one, how bad it is, and number two, whether CPAP works, and number three, what pressure the CPAP machine needs to be set to. And so there's no easy answer to your question. Do they think you have sleep apnea?
Well, actually, I guess my referring doctor doesn't have much experience with sleep disorders, so she's not certain about what it could be. You know, she just referred me to a specialist. And,
yeah, the a very good. I'd like to give you a couple of websites to go to. One of them is the website that's mentioned in the website associated with this program. There's a website that actually links to my book, and there's a place within that website that has online resources, and it has a lot of good online resources. The other good place for online resources is sleepfoundation.org. That's the National Sleep Foundation. They're in Washington, and they have an extremely well-developed website that that deals with all sorts of sleep disorders and talks about testing and stuff like that. At this point, you need more information, and right. you need to know why your doctor wants to send you for a sleep test. What does the doctor suspect?
Well, I mean, I've been going to her, you know, I've met with her a few times because of my sleep problems.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this is eventually, you know, she tried various different medication. Nothing seemed to help me. And eventually she said, you know, this is beyond my expertise. You
yeah.
need to be a sleep specialist.
Yeah. Well, I don't know how to advise you about that. The I know that when insurance doesn't cover certain treatments and certain tests, it can be very, very frustrating. Uh-huh. On the other hand, remember that not sleeping right and having a sleep disorder, it can imperil your life and it can make your life miserable. And
right.
and so you need to weigh the pros and cons of being tested and not being tested,
uh-huh.
And it's a difficult decision.
Right. Well, actually, my second question concerns the symptoms.
Okay.
At its worst, what happens with my sleep is that I tend to wake up,
mm-hmm.
and I find myself, like I find my heartbeat accelerating, so I can
mm-hmm.
actually feel my heart beating really fast.
Yeah.
And at that stage, I'm kind of wide awake.
Yeah.
Yeah,
there are several diseases that can cause that, several problems that can cause your heart to beat real fast when you wake up, and it can be very, very frightening. Sometimes it's nothing, and it's related to the fact that you may have had a frightening dream. Sometimes that's found in people with thyroid disease where they're producing too much thyroid hormone, and that causes the heart to speed up. It can also be caused in people that are under stress and have panic reactions when they sleep, and when they wake up in this panic state, it's actually an anxiety disorder that needs to be treated by a psychiatrist. And sometimes it's actually a symptom of heart disease because in some people they develop arrhythmias, abnormal heartbeats, when they sleep. So it could be any one of those things. So so it's something that you should look into because if you're waking up and your heart is pounding real hard, that's not normal.
Oh, well, thank you very much. It's been very useful.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. We've used up all the time. Unfortunately, we have callers we can't take this afternoon. Dr. Krieger, obviously this is a very important topic, and it's something that people are very concerned about. And maybe at some point in the future, we could call on you again.
Thank you very much. I'd be delighted.
Mayor Krieger has been our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. He's an MD. He's been diagnosing and treating people with sleep disorders for more than 25 years. He's currently director of the St. Boniface Sleep Lab, in Winnipeg, Canada. He's currently vice president of the National Sleep Foundation, and that's the website that he gave us this afternoon, www.sleepfoundation.org. He is the author of A Woman's Guide to Sleep Disorders. The book is published by McGraw-Hill. 9 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time, settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Dave Dickey.
Thank you very much, Celeste, and good afternoon, everyone. Well, in that wheat pit as well as that soybean pit, we did see a rally on the day after a softer opening this morning. We did have an upside down the bell, then down for much of the day, and rallying by the end of the day. CIF basis at the Gulf increasing to 90 cents, an increase of about 7-8 cents today. We are still looking for beans to fill the pipeline. Let's go ahead and get started, though, as we always do in the wheat pit. Looking for the March contract, a high on the day of 307 and three quarters, a low of 303 and a half, settling 307 and a half, up a quarter on the day. May, a high of 315 and a half, a low of 311, settling 315 and a quarter, up one. July, a high of 323, a low of 318 and a half, settling 322 and a half, up one. September, a high of 328 and a half, a low of 324 and a half, settling 328, up one and a half. December, a high of 336 and a half, a low of 333, settling 336, up one and a quarter on the day. March corn, a high on the day of $2, a low of 198 and a quarter, settling at $2, down a half. May, a high of 207 and three quarters, a low of 206 and a quarter, settling 207 and a half, down three quarters. July, a high of 215, a low of 213 and a quarter, settling 214 and three quarters, down three quarters. September, a high of 222 and a half, a low of 220 and three quarters, settling 222, down three quarters. December corn, a high of 232, a low of 230, settling 231 and a half, down one. March, a high of 239 and a quarter, a low of 237 and a half, settling 239, down three quarters on the day. March oats, a high of 165, a low of 163 and a quarter, settling 164 and a quarter, up a half. And May, a high of 157, a low of 156, settling on the low, unchanged on the day. January soybeans, a high of 558, a low of 548 and a half, settling 557 and a half, up 3 and a half. March, a high of 538, a low of 526 and three quarters, settling 536 and a half, up 2 and three quarters. May, a high of 540, a low of 530 and a quarter, settling 539, up 2 and three quarters. July, a high of 546, a low of 536 and a quarter, settling 544 and three quarters, up 3 and a quarter. August, a high of 546, a low of 538 and a half, settling 546, up 2 and 1 half. September, a high of 546, a low of 540, settling 546, up 3. And November, a high of 558, a low of 546, settling 556 and a half, up 5 on the day. January soybean meal, a high of 168, a low of 164.10, settling 167.70, up 220. March, a high of 162.50, a low of 159.10, settling 161.60, down 30. January soybean oil, a high of 1996, a low of 1948, settling 1996, and a high settlement up 35 on the day. And then the March contract, a high of 2010, a low of 1953, settling 2008, up 39 on the day. Settlement prices are also in on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, and Celeste has those.
Thank you, Dave. It looks like it was a mixed day, although maybe we could call it mostly higher day today for livestock prices. January feeder cattle, the high 106.17 and a half, the low 105.25, the settlement 106.15, that up 40. March 102.60, the high 101.55, the low 102.40, the settlement, that up 2.5. April feeder cattle, $100.82 the high, $100 even the low. The settlement, $100.82 that down 10 cents. January live cattle, the high, low, and settlement, the number across the screen, 93 even, that up $1. February, 92 even the high, 91 even the low, 91.17 the settlement, that down 87.5. April live cattle, 89.65 the high, 88.75 the low, 89.52 the settlement, that down 27.5. February lean hog, 76.57 the high, 75.32 the low, 76.20 the settlement, that up 40. April 77.90 the high, 76.35 the low, the settlement 77.67 that up 60. May lean hog 76.85 the high, 76 even the low, 76.75 the settlement, that up 32.5. June lean hog 78.47 the high, the low 77.20, the settlement 78.35, that up 15. And February bellies 95.80 the high, 95.05 the low, the settlement 95.42.5, that down 10. The Dow is off 48 points at 10,570. The NASDAQ off 4 at 2089. And the S&P 500 off 2 points at 1185.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 85 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
It's 3 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time. Coming up, we're going to have Ask Dr. Science, and then I'll give you the weather in depth from meteorologist Scott Althoff. But I do want to make mention that in the WILL severe weather coverage area, we have a couple of advisories, a snow advisory in effect for Ford County until 6 o'clock this evening, and a winter weather advisory in effect until 6 p.m. for Champaign, DeWitt, Piatt, Moultrie, Douglas, and Vermilion counties in central Illinois. It's 31 degrees in Urbana. And the weather has led the Urbana Adult Education Department, or those folks there, to cancel their evening classes. Again, the Urbana Adult Education evening classes, they are canceled tonight.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Devro TPAC in Danville, Dick's Pharmacy, Arthur, EAGCO Incorporated, Fairmont, and Citizen Sandwich and Convenience, Champaign. These business partners join the friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Mary Beth Norris from Lafayette, Indiana writes, "Dear Dr. Science, if I can fax a document across the world, why can't I fax a parcel, or even myself?"
You can, but it really, really hurts. I have a fiber optic cable about 3 feet in diameter, and after once testing the system by faxing myself around the globe 10 times, I suffered only minor fax lag. But when I think of all the money I save in plane fares, the discomfort's well worth it. The real pain comes when you're first sucked into the system.